Good morning. Can you guys hear me okay? I'm thinking we're good. I appreciate y'all braving the blizzard to get out here today. I'm David. I'm one of the elders here at Village. And today we're going to be going through what you heard Carrie read through, Acts 15:36. If you want to go ahead and find your way there to the first verse. The Bibles that are in the pews there, we say this every week and we totally mean it. If you don't have a Bible at home or if you need one, grab it, take it home with you. We got plenty of them, and it's better in your hands than they're in the pew collecting dust during the week, so go for it. I've been told that I speak a little quickly, so if I start talking too fast, y'all just, you know, like amen real heartily and I'll know. I'm like, I'll take that as a sense. But to recap from last week when Aaron was talking, we left off kind of at a pivotal moment with Paul and the church in Antioch. So we had the Judean Pharisees that had kind of come into the midst of the brothers and sisters. They started stirring a little bit of discord there. The suggestion that was made was that, you know, that circumcision was a prerequisite to salvation. And that was kind of this, again, this is against the very foundation of our you know, belief system that Jesus is not enough. This extra thing was required to be saved. And what became of that is the church really kind of gathered together. They took it up a couple notches up the flagpole and went to Jerusalem, involved the elders, involved the apostles, and they've kind of penned this letter that says two things. The first of all, that Jesus alone is enough for salvation. Jesus is the key. And then the second is that anyone can be a Christian. So we're not excluding Gentiles here, which is what kind of the sentiment that had been shared at the time. So they've penned this letter and kind of unified under it. And then today what we're going to kind of be walking through is the second kind of half of that, where they've got the letter, they've got the information that they need to take to really go and encourage the remainder of the church, the New Testament church. But the goal is to get there and go back to those churches and encourage them, and we got to figure out how to do that. So this is a little bit different for Paul, right? Because Paul is known to go. He's, you know, he's Liam Neeson on the phone, like, I will find you and I will tell you about Jesus. Like, he's always going out and finding new unreached peoples. And so in this story, we're going to see where he kind of shifts back and he's on his second missionary journey. And in this case, we're rather than, you know, going to make new disciples, we're strengthening the ones that we have. So we're going to go ahead and jump to the first verse here. And there's a map because I hear that you guys like maps. So I'm going to take my pretty colors here and kind of draw, but we see kind of in the blue line here that's kind of the initial journey that Paul made, and then there's an orange kind of U-turn that he's making here. What we're starting to talk about is this little purple section here where he's kind of revisiting the churches along the way. So we're going to jump into the first verse for real this time. So Acts 15:36. After some time had passed, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let's go back and visit the brothers and sisters in every town where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they're doing." So we have to really kind of think contextually of where Paul's at in this moment, and Paul and Barnabas and the believers, they're energized, right? They're encouraged under this letter that they've written to, you know, their Gentile brothers and sisters to let them know you're part of this too. You're part of this church. And so the energy in Antioch would feel probably pretty incredible, right? And that's why at the first of the verse here where it says after some time, actually in the Greek there, it's kind of argued about how long Paul actually spent there in Antioch preaching Paul and Barnabas, but most theologians kind of lean towards about a year. So he spent really a year just kind of reveling in this ability to encourage the brothers and sisters and to unify the church. And I think that says a lot about how we're to feel about ministry and how when we interact with each other, when we're able to remove those stumbling blocks for each other, that's important, right? That's something we should celebrate and we should rejoice in. And when we do this, I want to make it clear that when we are removing those stumbling blocks and when we are, you know, being there for one another, coming alongside each other, as Aaron was talking about last week, we're loving like Jesus tells us to. In Matthew 25:37-40, then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." So that's what these guys are so excited about, right? They are doing exactly what Jesus told them to do. They're loving on each other. They are building each other up, and they are encouraging each other. And this is a unifying moment in the church. So, of course, Paul's going to want to stick around in Antioch. He's going to want to really kind of just enjoy that and be in that moment. But we see here in that Paul is kind of building on that momentum when he's talking to Barnabas here, that he's saying, you know, let's go back to the brothers and sisters. So that's what we saw in the verse before, right? That after some time passed, let's go back and visit the brothers and sisters. Let's take this party, and let's take this party to them. Let's unify, further unify the New Testament church, as we've already seen here in Antioch. And so as we look at this, he's kind of, again, he's demonstrating kind of a shift in his ministry, but he's not changing the mission at hand. He's been intentionally, relentlessly reaching out to these new groups, but we see that he's proving to us, he's showing us that it's just as important to be invested in the believers, the existing believers that we have here, and pour into them as well. And as we go through this, I'm going to pull out kind of three little nuggets for us as a collective, as a church, as a body of believers to really cling to when we do ministry together, when we walk through this life together. And so this is going to be kind of the first one, but I wanted to preface that's what we're going through. So the first thing that we see here in Paul's objective shift is that the seeds of faith must be sown and patiently cultivated. So evangelism isn't this one-and-done event, right? It's not this youth camp revival, you know, we're super excited, we're all singing our songs and everything. We're on the church bus still singing all the way back, and we're pumped, and we just continue that flame all the way through our lives. Unfortunately, that's not how it works. That's not how we're designed. And God recognizes this in the way that he gives us resources to kind of pour into. In a way, he gives us this community so that we can build one another up and encourage a brother or sister who's struggling. And so, just so you know that we're clear here, evangelism is not a one-and-done event, and whether it's we're witnessing or building a church, the health of our relationship with Jesus is contingent on our continued devotion, our learning, and our teaching, and our submitting to the gospel. So Paul isn't like going off the rails here. Paul isn't changing the mission at hand. Paul is doing exactly what we're commissioned to do, and no better place to reference than the Great Commission. So Matthew 28:18, "Therefore go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you." So that last part there, "and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you," arguably just as important as going out and reaching new peoples is continuing to make sure that we are staying gospel true, that we are upholding the integrity of this book, that we are pouring into one another, and we're keeping each other on the guardrails. And so, I mean, a good way to like kind of contextually look at this in Scripture in the Old Testament is the way the Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. God spent 40 years teaching them to have faith, to trust in him. That's a long lesson plan. That is a long class. I don't think that I could have sat for 40 years and listened to a teacher lecture. But that is the context that we have here, is that teaching is a process. It's something that takes time, dedication, and patience. A more practical example, both of my boys are in soccer right now. And it's the third year that my older son, Mason, he's in soccer. And watching him is just kind of exciting for me as a dad, because he moves the ball with intention. He's able to work with his teammates really well, just cohesively. He listens to his coach. He's really picking it up. My four-year-old Ezra, this is his first year, and he struggles to understand why the other team won't share the ball with him. He thought it would be a great idea during their last scrimmage to, he just went to the coach's bag and got himself a ball because they wouldn't share with him. And then he scored a goal, which was great. But that's just kind of it's a funny example to explain that teaching is, it takes time, and learning takes time. And it takes dedication from both the teacher and the learner. So that coach, I'm praying for my four-year-old's coach, because he's going to have to be dedicated to the lesson just as much as Ezra's going to have to be dedicated to the lesson. Applications for us. This is why it's so critical for us to not just hear the word preached 30 minutes a week. This is why this gathering here is amazing and beautiful and wonderful, but it's not enough to sustain you and feed you spiritually. That's why we need to be in the Word. That's why we need to be digging into the gospel and coming alongside one another and doing things outside of 30 minutes a week. And Paul demonstrates this in that urgent pull that he has from Antioch, right? Because he's really enjoying this time with his brothers and sisters, we can tell, and we would rejoice in that as well, but there's work to do. So he's being pulled out so he can go do that work. So continuing kind of on with the story, in verse 37, 38, Barnabas wanted to take along John, who was called Mark. But Paul insisted that they should not take along this man who had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not gone on with them to do the work. So they've kind of agreed here. We can infer that Barnabas has agreed now to Paul that we're going to go on this, you know, health inspection tour of the churches that we've been before. We're going to go make sure, we're going to white glove it. We're going to make sure that the theology that they're teaching is appropriate. We're also going to disseminate the decisions that were from the elders and the apostles. We're gonna go and we're gonna encourage. We're gonna go and take this message to them. But what we know about Paul, what we all have seen demonstrated throughout Acts, is that he's gone quite a ways. So they've got a lot of ground to cover. I mean, he's probably gone through like seven pairs of chacos at this point, where he's gonna need to take a team along with him. So the idea here, it makes sense, right? We want to bring somebody else along with us, and it makes sense to bring maybe somebody who's less tenured, maybe somebody who need a disciple that needs a little bit of encouragement, needs a little bit of room to grow. And it also makes sense because we're going back to places where the gospel's already been shared. So the soil is softer here. There's lower barriers to entry. There's a community of believers that's waiting there to receive them. And so this is a great opportunity for a younger disciple to go and engage and really get involved in this ministry. But it seems like it's a little, there's kind of a little discord here. And things are getting a little bit heated between Paul and Barnabas over the subject of Mark. So Mark is Barnabas's cousin, who back in Acts 13, and I've got the verse here. In Acts 13, Mark kind of went off and did his own thing, if you guys remember a few weeks back. So in Acts 13, Paul and his companions set sail for Paphos and came to Perga in Pamphylia, but John left them and went back to Jerusalem. They continued their journey from Perga and reached Pisidian Antioch. So that's all we get, right? John just kind of departed. And what we can infer is that John maybe, or Mark, didn't quite have the dedication that maybe Paul was looking for in this moment. When Chase was preaching this part, he went through a little bit of like the traversal between Perga and Antioch and how the terrain was really brutal and there were diseases along the way. There were roaming bandits. And so we can think that it's going to take a really unwavering commitment to make this journey. Mark, on the other hand, he just doesn't seem to really have that here. We're not really given a lot of insight into why he left. We can infer that maybe he missed home or that he was scared of the journey. But there's not really a lot of detail there. But we're also not, when we fast forward to where we are at currently, we're not really given rationale as to why, you know, Paul is still kind of at odds with Mark joining them. We don't really know his rationale, but it's clear that he's either not forgiven him if he feels like this was a slight against him, or at least he doesn't feel like Mark is ready. Like Mark's not quite ready for this journey. Barnabas, on the other hand, you know, his cousin, he does seem to want to bring him along. He seems like he thinks that maybe Mark's either turned a corner, maybe he does recognize that the soil is softer and that he thinks that this would be a great opportunity to bring Mark up. And we know that he's known as the son of encouragement, so maybe he's just more empathetic to the worries and concerns of Mark. Either way, we can tell here that these two guys, you know, the biblical power couple of Paul and Barnabas are at odds over this. So let's go on to the next verse so we can kind of see how they deal with this conflict. So in Acts 15, verse 39, they had such a sharp disagreement that they parted company, and Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed off to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and departed after being commended by the brothers and sisters to the grace of the Lord. He traveled through Syria and Sicilia, strengthening the churches. Well, this is a little bit of a bummer, right? That's kind of unexpected because Paul and Barnabas have been a cohesive unit this whole time. I mean, this is Batman and Robin, and they're spreading the gospel everywhere they go, and they're one. I mean, we can infer that Paul, I mean, from the way that Paul addresses individuals, people along the way, he's calling people snakes, and he's doing these things, whereas Barnabas, again, is the encourager. He's coming around. He didn't mean that. He meant that, but he didn't mean that. They are a great team, and they love each other. I mean, they've been doing ministry for over a decade, so this is a little discouraging to see that they've kind of decided to part ways here. So what does this tell us about doing ministry together and evangelism as a whole? It tells us that conflict is inevitable, but in disagreement, we should remain unified in our purpose. Because even though that Barnabas and Paul are at odds with one another, their plan was initially they're going to go on this health inspector tour together, they're going to go back, strengthen the disciples, they're going to share the message. The decision that they make pretty quickly is that I'm going to take Silas, you're going to take Mark, and we're going to go our separate ways, but we're going to continue to do the work. We're not stopping. We're not letting this disagreement discourage us or sideline us. We're going to move forward with the work, and we're going to continue to do what Jesus has sent us to do. And I know kind of what the thought process that was going in the back of my mind, and I don't know if it's going back in your mind, but it's kind of like in conflict, often we're wondering, well, who was right? Who was in the right? Who was wrong in this case? Luke doesn't really, when Luke's writing this, he doesn't really affirm or condemn Mark's actions or Mark's decision to return to Jerusalem. We don't have details of his motives, like I was saying before. Luke also doesn't take sides between Paul and Barnabas. He makes mention that the church did commend Silas to go with Paul, but he's not rebuking anything that Barnabas is doing. And as the gospel is the living, breathing word of God, if there was a sin issue here, I think we can be pretty confident that Luke would have woven that into the story. We would have realized that there's something here that one of these brothers is doing that's impeding the work that Jesus sent them to do. So their disagreement here is a matter of, it's a difference of temperament and perspective, and it's not because of sin. And the elders are probably nodding their heads because that I lifted this straight from our elders meeting agenda, because we start every time that we meet together as a group, we have this kind of just these tenets that we read through. And one of the things that we read says that we may disagree as a matter of temperament and perspective, not necessarily because of sin. And then right after that, no relationship is on the line tonight. And I think that that's something that we can adopt holistically as a church, and Paul and Barnabas clearly adopted here. Because the fact is that we're going to disagree, right? We're not going to always see eye to eye as believers. We're going to butt heads over things. We're going to argue right here in the sanctuary over different things that we just, you know, matters of temperament, points of prudence that we just don't necessarily disagree on. And don't hear what I'm not saying. There can be disagreements and arguments where it may be rooted in there's a theological issue. There may be disagreements that we have that are rooted in sin, but we should be quick to give the benefit of the doubt to brothers and sisters of the faith that that's not the case. We should make sure that we're taking the kind of same litmus test of when we're considering our own motives, we should be thinking optimistically of our brothers and sisters as well. The litmus test that I kind of wrote out here is what I would say how we can determine whether conflict is edifying us or distracting us is to consider their position and say, am I operating in obedience to Jesus? It's that simple. And is the position that I'm holding, is that out of pride? Is that out of something that I'm digging my heels in on unnecessarily? Or is it because I believe that this is the most effective way to do what God has sent me to do? So for Paul and Barnabas, we can answer that pretty effectively, right? It's yes. These men have dedicated their entire lives to the mission of Jesus. They have sacrificed life and limb. Literally, Paul's getting beaten up and thrown out of churches. Again, he called people snakes. He probably had it coming. But they very clearly are dedicated to the mission at hand. And there's a passion to their viewpoints that's rooted in this mutual desire to move the gospel, to expand the gospel as effectively as they possibly can. So we should seek God's will in all of our decisions. We should seek God's will, and we should hold those positions, those points of prudence that we have. But again, we should give our brothers and sisters the benefit of the doubt and confirm internally, do a self check. Is obedience to Jesus our priority in the way that we're in the midst of this conflict? So because of their mutual obedience, we can see that God does a great work in the church. Arguably, like, they would have traveled slower, right? There's a number of things that we can see God's hand in here in separating the brothers. They wouldn't have been able to reach as many countries as quickly as they did, get to as many peoples as quickly as they did. Notably, Barnabas and Paul both kind of go back to their own kind of home areas. And so it's also giving them an opportunity to meet with their families, maybe get further encouragement, things like that. We're not really sure, you know, what exactly God's doing here, but we can see that it's for the benefit of the church. And just a few verses later, I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit to this verse. We'll come back to it again, but just to kind of drive this point home, as they traveled to the towns and delivered the decisions reached by the apostles and the elders at Jerusalem for the people to observe. So the churches were strengthened in the faith and grew daily in numbers. So clearly, right here, we can see whatever this disagreement was, God's in it. God's using this disagreement. God's using the separation for his purposes. Because the church is getting stronger. The church is growing. And not to leave, you know, like on a sour note with, you know, our Batman and Robin separating and you know, leaving with a fight. We can see that there's reconciliation in this. Just a little while later, 2 Timothy 4:11, we can see Paul's talking very favorably of Mark here. Only Luke is with me. Bring Mark with you, for he is useful to me in the ministry. In Colossians 4:10, we see Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, sends you greetings, as does Mark, Barnabas' cousin, concerning whom you have received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him. So Paul's temperament is changing here. Paul, there's redemption, there's encouragement here and that's encouraging for me personally, because how encouraging is that when we fall, when we disagree, when we butt heads with our brothers and sisters, that there is forgiveness and there is redemption and Jesus can still use us no matter what the circumstances were prior. Jesus can mold that and shape that and still use us. So we get through this, you know, point of contention, that we get through the separation, and then the way that Luke kind of takes this story here, and I'll go ahead and pop to the next verse, but before I go, the way this is looking out is it's panning out like this cinematic of this, you know, hostile fight between Paul and Barnabas. We're zoomed in on both of them. They both just cannot seem to disagree. They turn about face and they separate. And the camera kind of just pans over to Paul. And we're now following Paul in the continuation of the story. So here in Acts 16:1, Paul went on to Derbe and Lystra, where there was a disciple named Timothy, the son of a believing Jewish woman, but his father was a Greek. The brothers and sisters at Lystra and Iconium spoke highly of him. So there's a lot to unpack right here in this one little section. But what we can kind of infer is that Paul, now traveling, you know, separate from Barnabas, maybe Barnabas has grown enough to where he's, you know, doing his own thing. And Paul's kind of, his mentality, again, it's shifted from taking the gospel out to strengthening the disciples. But he's also kind of starting to think about his team and think about the disciples that he's taking under his wing, because Barnabas is kind of, he's flown the coop. He's doing his own thing. This has kind of given Paul the mental space to consider maybe bringing on somebody new. And in this moment, God brings him Timothy, brings them to Timothy. And so this is really cool, right? Because God used the division of two of his top guys to bring them to somebody who we're going to find out soon is going to create a lot of unity for the church. He's going to use Timothy for something really great. And what I want to do before I kind of get into how cool this is that Timothy is here with them now, it kind of takes me to my third point, which is that God can and he does use division to further the spread of the gospel, which that's kind of, it seems difficult to kind of take in the moment when we're frustrated, when we're kind of bummed that we're in the midst of that conflict, but it's so true, right? And And I'll be transparent with you guys. I had originally written this, that God can use division to multiply the gospel, because I'm a nerd, and I was like, oh, it's a math joke. But I would put that in there. But seriously, this is really cool, right? If we zoom in on Timothy here and look at this, Timothy, he has a really unique experience. He is the son of a Jewish woman and a Greek man. And we know enough about the cultural, you know, context of the area that the Greeks and Jews are kind of like the Hatfields and McCoys, right? They're really just at odds with each other culturally, religiously. They don't agree on laws, a lot of things. But Timothy's got both. He's got both in his family tree here. So that gives him a really unique perspective, right? He's been privy to both the customs, both of the, you know, the religious tensions of both of his parents. So what's really cool is that he's kind of a descendant of this division. He exists in spite of the religious and cultural tensions between these two groups. And God is bringing Paul to him in the midst of division. It's crazy. We can also see that, you know, in this second section here, just to kind of zoom in, the brothers and sisters at Lystra and Iconium spoke highly of him. So Lystra, just for some cultural context, Lystra was predominantly Greek and Jewish. So that's the you know, makeup of their population, whereas Iconium was largely Hellenistic. So we've got like a spectrum of individuals, cultural groups, religious groups, all in this area. And Luke very, you know, affirmatively states that, you know, he was spoken highly of in the midst of all of this. Timothy is a unifying presence in the midst of division. So I just want to kind of recap all of this, because, again, there was a lot to unpack in this one section here. But God led his disciples to a child who was found because of division, who exists in spite of division, and who ultimately will strengthen the unity of the believers. That's a God mic drop. Like, I can't write that any differently than how it is. So kind of hop into the next verse right after this. Paul wanted Timothy to go with him, so he took him and he circumcised him because of the Jews who were in those places, since they all knew that his father was a Greek. Yeah, we're talking about circumcision again. I'm sorry, 2 weeks in a row, guys. I really apologize. But this is important here, because this is where we kind of see the heart behind Paul's ministry and behind who Timothy is. So part of the whole health inspection tour, right, was to take the decisions that were rendered in Jerusalem and take them to the brothers and sisters of the different churches that they'd been to. And the whole point, the whole debacle was over circumcision. The whole just disagreement was because these Judaizers came down and said, you need to be circumcised or you can't be saved. And Paul and Barnabas very, you know, fervently defended against that. They fought against it. They said, that's not the case. Jesus is enough. We know that this is the truth. Circumcision, you don't need a ritual. You don't need anything extra. You just need Jesus. So this feels kind of odd, right? That Paul would take him and circumcise him. And it is written like that, but I want to be clear, like, this was probably a conversation with Timothy and Paul, right? Because Timothy's a younger kid, but he's old enough to where he's kind of past the point of the whole circumcision conversation. But Paul probably had to sit down with Timothy and explain this, you know, this part of his heart that is going to lead to the action that he's about to take. And Paul is clearly anticipating kind of a resistance here to Timothy's presence. And we have to unpack that, because we can't just ignore the fact that we just told the brothers and sisters that circumcision was irrelevant, and now he's taking his new number two and he's circumcising him. So what's up with that? Well, there's two implications here that we need to really consider. The first is kind of this logistical, cultural element that Jewish synagogues at the time, they did not permit uncircumcised men from being there in the presence of the synagogue, preaching, things like that. For the most part, they kind of barred the door there. I would hate to be that bouncer that has to confirm all that stuff. But the second more, you know, illustrative point, and this is really beautiful, and I really want to kind of sit here in this. This second illustration, or the purpose of the circumcision, is absolutely upholding the unity, that our unity under Christ. So Paul is erring on the side of caution with his personal ministry here. He recognizes that the fact that Timothy is both Greek and Jewish, that there is kind of a choice involved here with circumcision, that there could be a perception of somebody who's potentially not been reached yet, or a perception of a Gentile brother or sister, that there's a decision for Timothy that wasn't there for them. He is recognizing, just like we were talking about back in Antioch, he's recognizing that there's a stumbling block here. There's stumbling blocks that are laying here in front of the brothers and sisters, and he's looking for an opportunity, a proactive mitigation of this. He's taking away those stumbling blocks in an effort to make Timothy's ministry more effective, more impactful. And Timothy, again, his circumcision could create division among the brothers because of his family history. And I want to be clear that Paul is not, he's not going above the decisions that were made at Jerusalem. He's not going against what that was. Paul is exhibiting, and Timothy more specifically here, he's exhibiting love. He is loving, he loves Jesus enough to make this personal sacrifice so that his ministry will be more effective, so that the word will be able to penetrate more evenly and cleanly and without any kind of barriers. This is, we talk about suffering. We've talked about suffering for the past couple of weeks, righteous suffering, and how God asks us to, you know, make sacrifices along the way, and that sanctification is not a, you know, a process. Chase always says the process doesn't tickle. This right here, circumcision in this case for Timothy, this is a beautiful demonstration. This is a beautiful illustration of dying to self. This is giving up something that you don't necessarily have to. We made it very clear. You don't need to be circumcised. You're not getting circumcised doesn't add any square footage to your mansion in heaven. It's not going to change the outcome of where you end up in eternity. It's not going to make you more favorable in the eyes of God. But the fact that it could potentially cause a brother or a sister to fall, the fact that it could potentially prevent a soul from being reached, that was enough. That was enough for Timothy to take this step. That was enough. He had enough love in his heart, the love of Jesus, to be able to make this sacrifice. And this is something that we see in Paul's ministry, right? Elsewhere in the ministry, he did the same thing with food. So in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 8:13, therefore, if food causes my brother or sister to fall, I will never again eat meat so that I won't cause my brother or sister to fall. I mean, it's very straightforward there. I mean, Paul, you know, granted, you know, circumcision and not eating bacon anymore are two totally separate things, but the fact of the matter is, it's sacrifice. It's dying to self, and we've already again established Jesus is enough. These other things don't matter, but there's enough love there for the potential of a misrepresentation of the gospel or for somebody to potentially miss Jesus that we're making those sacrifices anyway. So we're going to move on to the last two verses there. Acts 16, verse 4 and 5. So as they traveled to the towns, and we just read this earlier, but solidifying here, as they traveled to the towns, they delivered the decisions reached by the apostles and the elders at Jerusalem for the people to observe. So stopping here for a second, again, Paul is, he's still doing what he set out to do. He's taking that letter, he's still upholding what he agreed to, what they agreed to there in Jerusalem and in Antioch, and encouraging the brothers and sisters the exact same way that he was there. Nothing has changed. He's still pushing that message, and he's still submitting to the authority of those elders. And then the last part there, so the churches were strengthened in the faith and grew daily in numbers. So again, he's proceeding to move in unity despite division. And what does God do? God strengthens. God grows. God can use division. He does use division and conflict to grow and to grow the ministry. So this is another great example, it's very similar to Timothy, how he was born in division and he was used to unify. Those Judaizers were using that, their false teaching, to cause division in the church, and it was causing division. But that division inked a letter that now is creating unity. It's strengthening the church again. God is moving in that, and you just can't make it up. It's another great example of a God mic drop. So I want to go back just and touch on the three little nuggets that I pulled out of this text and look at kind of from an application perspective strictly on these. So the seeds of faith must be sown and patiently cultivated. Sticking with that one, again, evangelism isn't this one and done event. We can't talk to our neighbor about Jesus one time and expect that it will bear fruit. We can't see someone saved or converted, a new brother or a new sister, and then pat them on the back and say, you know, go do a good work. We have to be invested. We have to pour into one another and build each other up along the way and recognize that we all have different weaknesses. We all grow weary. And this is an opportunity for us as a church to really unify under the energy that we saw there at Antioch. They are so unified, and they're encouraged and they're rejoicing because they are doing exactly what Christ has asked us to do, to pull out those stumbling blocks and to love one another the way that he loves us. And again, it's not that youth camp moment. We're not going to stay on fire from one moment for the rest of our lives. We have to stoke that fire. We have to be in the Word. We have to be reading. We have to be doing more than just a 30-minute sermon every Sunday. We have to be invested, and this walk that we're on, this journey that we're on, is lifelong. It's not temporary, and it doesn't take up 15% of our time or 20% of our time. It is constantly running in the DNA of who we are. I want to read John 13, 34 through 35, and I didn't put it in the slides. I kind of threw this in last moment because I want to again go back to what really is the motivation behind, truly the motivation behind suffering in this context. I give you a new command, love one another, just as I have loved you. You are also to love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. So by this, everyone will know. I feel like that is very clearly evangelism, right? That the whole separation between going and sending versus pouring into what we have here, sometimes I think we create this like hierarchical kind of idea in our head that, you know, the missions, what's going on in Kampala, Uganda is so important, and it's so much more important than what's going on here, but it's not. What we're doing right here in this community is just as important, and this is evidential right here in the text. This is how we do ministry. We love one another, and we do it here, and we do it out there, and collectively as a group, that's how we have to do the evangelism. We can't go half-heartedly here locally. We can't be for the city and not for the world. We can't be for the world and not be for the city. We have to have both, because that's what Christ calls us to do. And love is going to manifest differently with one another along the way, right? It's going to be an encouraging text here or there from, you know, if somebody's having a hard time. It's going to be sending a meal to somebody who's expecting a baby, or, you know, coming alongside them and being there for them for resources that they may need. It could also be confronting somebody in sin. It could also be talking to somebody who you see going through a hard time and you recognize that it's something that they've got going on with their own walk that's not right, and you need to step in there, and that's love. That's met the manifestation of our love of Jesus that we're reciprocating and giving to a brother or sister. And it's going to be uncomfortable sometimes, but it's critical for our spiritual health, both individually and as a body, so that we can further unify together. The second point, again, conflict is inevitable, but in discord, we need to remain united in our obedience to Christ. Remember the litmus test I was talking about before. We're going to have arguments over stupid things. I don't like the font that's in the bulletin. I don't like, you know, the coffee creamer that's on the bar, which I brought the coffee creamer today, so if you didn't like it, that's on me. But these little points of prudence and things, they're going to crop up. There's going to be some things. We're going to butt heads. Conflict is inevitable, even amongst the believers. We see that with Paul and Barnabas. But we have to look internally. We have to reflect. We have to take that litmus test and say, am I digging my heels in out of pride? Is the position that I've taken out of pride, or is it because I want to love others like Jesus? Is it out of, you know, my own sense of self-worth and ego, or is it because I want to spread the gospel as effectively as possible, and that's why I'm so passionate about this? We have to decide between those two things. We have to do that self-check. And we need to give each other the benefit of the doubt that we are doing those self-checks internally, that when you're disagreeing with a brother or a sister, when there's something, the point of prudence that you guys are not aligned on, you're giving them the benefit of the doubt that they are still sanctified by the same Jesus that you are, and they are still of the same mission mindset that you are, and that those two points, that is not necessarily a tension that can't be reconciled. There's a quote that comes from theologian Matthew Henry, and I really didn't want to quote somebody, but he caps this so beautifully. I was reading a commentary of his, and I want to read it to you guys before I move on to the last point. Even those that are united to one and the same Jesus and sanctified by one and the same Spirit have different apprehensions, different opinions, different views, different sentiments, and points of prudence. It will be so while we are in this state of darkness and imperfection. We shall never be all of a mind till we come to heaven where light and love are perfect. And amen to that. Like, I can't wait till we're all unified of one mind and celebrating in heaven together. And there's no, it doesn't matter that I brought gross coffee creamer, because we all love one another, and we're all unified under that love of Jesus and Spirit of Jesus. The Jerusalem Council, Paul and Barnabas, we see debate, we see disagreement, we see tension, but we see that this is all under that umbrella of wanting to take the gospel and effectively reach others, wanting to do what Christ has commissioned us to do. And that's the core. That's the core issue that we have to tackle when we're in the midst of conflict. We have to understand that as a body of believers that we're fighting for the integrity of Christ's bride. And if that's the case, conflict is going to happen, and that's okay. And then the third and last point, is that God can use division to further the gospel. And when I think about, like, this part, the quote that kept jumping out of my head was, like, change is part of life. And I know that's like a rom-com Hallmark type thing, you know, that the lawyer girl from the city moves to the country and meets her boyfriend that's a lumberjack, and they get married. And this change is so important, right? It's change. Our culture just pushes change, change, change. But in this case, they're really not wrong, because I think the thing that we tend to forget is that even though God never changes, we are very fallible, and we falter and we stumble. And just like the quote from Matthew Henry, we have different opinions and different apprehensions, and so we're changing our hearts. This is why we're so invested in staying in the Word. This is why that we're meeting together as frequently as we can and investing in ministry and getting involved and sharing our gospel story. Is because we're allowing that light of Jesus to shine through us and continue to change us every day. And so that change is going to happen. That change is inevitable, and that's good. And it can also hurt, right? Because Paul and Barnabas, they separated. They were the best of friends. They were of the same mind. They had an effective ministry going. They loved each other. They continued to love each other even after that separation. That's a hard thing, to lose a friend, to lose a loved one. That's something that hurts, and that's part of that suffering that we talked about before. That is an element of that suffering. But if we're doing that, if we're going through that suffering and the motivation behind that is the love of Jesus and that unified love of Jesus, then the tension and the transition that we go through is worth it. And God already knows what He's doing with it. We don't have to worry about what the outcome is going to be, because God is already pulling us through that. We may lose brothers and sisters along the road. Maybe temporarily, maybe permanently, and that hurts, and it's hard. It'll be difficult, but again, we have to rest that it's not by our power. When we face division, when we're discouraged that the path is difficult and long, we're gonna grow weary, guys. We're at this side of heaven, just like Matthew Henry was saying. It's tiring sometimes. It is exhausting sometimes to continue this day after day and see discouragement around us. But in this room together as a body of believers, we are called to pull together, and in the weariness of a brother or a sister, come alongside them, pull them up, strengthen them. And that is exactly a replication of what Jesus did for us. So when we face division, when we're discouraged, we can rest that He's already prepared a beautiful destination for our arrival. And again, in that rest, we can rest that it's not by anything we do. It's not by circumcision. It's not by what foods we eat. It's not what old laws that we cling to. It's the power of Jesus alone. It's Jesus Christ's blood that was poured out for all of us, Jew and Gentile. And that's an unmatched power that we can't have any impact on at all. And it's his will that's going to be done through that. And it has nothing to do with those actions that we take. So we can rest in that today. I know I probably flew through this. I know usually it's like a 50-minute thing. It's probably 20 minutes by now. But those are the nuggets of wisdom that I kind of pulled out of this today. And I just want to encourage us all that if you're going through a conflict right now, if you're at odds with a friend, if there's something, you know, that's stirring in you where we have that human pull that wants to say who's right, who's wrong. But if it's with a brother or a sister in here, work through that and consider what God could be doing through that. And so that's it, guys. Let's pray. God, I thank you for the example that we have in Acts. I thank you for the New Testament church, the ministry of Paul and Barnabas that we're able to walk through and see that they were human too. To see that our biblical heroes are just as human, just as accessible to us hundreds of years ago as we are today in ministry. I thank you for their example, and I thank you for your living proof that you can and you will use division to further your gospel, further your reach. That in our weakness, that you are strong. That in your power. We try as we might to do things to measure up, to bring you works, to try and further the work that you already completed, but they're filthy rags, God. And Jesus, your sacrifice is enough, and we are unified under that. And it is in these things we love you. We ask in your name, amen.